Welcome to the Ages of Rock podcast with your hosts, Bill Algy, Dennis Talbot, and Alan Tate. We are three guys who have one thing in common, a love of rock and roll. Our goal is to talk about all things rock. We hope you find this show intriguing, funny, and occasionally highly opinionated. Enjoy. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode number 357 of the Ages of Rock podcast. This week, we have our esteemed fellow podcast colleague, Julian Gill, here, and he will be talking about his latest book, Mass Hysteria. I almost said Cast Mysteria.
Yes. Whatever you want to say.
It's Hysteria. This is really a book about Def Leppard. which happens to be another band that Julian is a fan of, but no, seriously, it's Mass Hysteria, and it talks about the Kiss World Tour from 1980 to 1981. What's going on, Julian?
Gentlemen, it's an honor and a privilege to get to join you remotely. You know, it's been a few months since Nashville, so good to see you all again.
Oh, yes.
You said gentlemen. And it's nice to see us. That's something we're not used to. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, it's all downhill from there.
The niceties are gone at this point.
Niceties are done. Let's rumble.
Thank goodness, man. I don't like all that smoozy crap. That's for sure. No, cool, man. Hey, it was a good book. Great book. Book review is, look, I made some tabs with notes.
You made some tabs. I just got mine yesterday.
So it's either typos.
Well, there's a couple of them. I was going to tell you.
Or things you disagree with.
There's just a couple of typos. It wasn't that big a deal. I'm not that much of a, you know. You got to see my emails.
Some of his text messages are glorious.
They are.
Yeah. So, Julian, real quick.
I don't give a shit about
that. How long did it take you to put this together?
Just like 2 years. But, I mean, really, it's a bit more because the whole idea of doing an on-tour dedicated to a single tour goes back to 2017. I did all these like little on tour ones. This is the one from Unmasked from back then. Sure. When it was that big, it put on some weight since, like the rest of us, or at least me.
It's
been a few years since I said I wanted to do it, into, you know, gathering everything that I had and then seeing what I didn't have and seeing what other people were willing to contribute and then seeing how it all fit together. So about 18 months, I think, all together.
It's nice. It looks really good. Like I said, whenever Alan, we talked about this a little bit beforehand, but I borrowed Alan's because I just got back from vacation. I didn't have a chance to get it. And, you know, of course, I've got your other books, you know, and usually, you know, there are lots of facts and figures and, you know, and I'm like, I'm looking at this one. I was like, this has got pictures.
this is in color.
This is in color. I mean, this is the little boy in me went, oh, I can actually, I'm going to really like this. So yeah, I got on Amazon.
This one had to be color. It couldn't just be some long form, you know, black and white. You know, here's a bunch of interviews. Read basically some sort of structure into that. I didn't want to do this one like Tim and I had done the solo albums book, or Odyssey, or like I later attempted to do with the Crazy Nights book. This is one that really needed to have memos. This needed to have screen captures from videos. It needed ads. It needed newspaper clippings. And it needed to be a scrapbook because I wanted to experiment with what it looked like and how it would be received. To kind of do that format for a full tour feature, because that's essentially what it is. It's Mass Hysteria. It's about 1980, and that is about the tour with Eric Carr, the first tour with Eric Carr. So it was a personal challenge. It was just, can I do this, and will people like it? We're still finding out the latter.
One of my favorite things about this is you talked about the newspaper clippings and everything. You know, I like the fact that you can read those newspaper clippings. Excuse me, because I know a lot of people will put a picture of a clipping in there, but it'll be blurry, or, you know, it'll be a photocopy of a photocopy, and it's really illegible in a lot of those books. But I've yet to come across anything that I couldn't read well in this book.
No, that's critically important. You know, I don't want everything to be readable, so some stuff is obscured, you know, rather than having just a stack of things thrown together. But I wanted people, you know, for translations, for example, where I've run things through translators and all that, to have the English versions, to have the original text beside from the newspaper clippings, and to see how they actually looked, I think really gives you more of a sense of them as well. Mm-hmm. So I want people to be able to read them. And also it means I don't have to transcribe everything either, you know, because a lot of the things that are pictures are not just transcribed. It's just not repetition, even though I'm often guilty of repetition.
I'm a member of the Department of Redundancy Department.
I'm fully redundant.
Yeah, I only found but it's kind of funny. Apparently I need to get my bifocals checked. Because there's a couple of like really small print things I was really struggling with, so I would actually use my phone and blow it up on the magnifying thing on the phone. There were some couple, and that's not a bad thing. It's just you know, trying to get stuff on a page, you can only fit so much on there.
I do joke that I'm giving KISS an opening here to do their officially licensed, because this is unofficial products. They can do an officially licensed KISS magnifying glass now, which they probably should be doing. Do you remember those reading prisms back in the day that grandparents had to go down the page? Yeah, yep. Have a KISS one. You know, come on. Gene, we're all at that age now. We're either wearing bifocals or worse. You know, so, you know, throw us a bone here. I've left you guys a marketing opening, you know, so I'll do this one was
a little
book.
This one was a little tough.
Yeah, that is. I mean, some of them are tough, but even with my eyesight, I figured that was a good kind of middle ground, that if I was able to read it without my glasses, the problem that I do kind of forget is that I've read these a lot, and I do have full 600 DPI scans of all this stuff, so I'm blowing them up on the screen, and I'm like, oh yeah, I could read that. It's like cheater. When you memorize the lines of the eye doctor.
I got my readers on. I've got my readers on. I can, if I get to the right distance, I can see.
Yeah, you
got to
make sure your head's right so you don't end up drowning or something.
With enough bourbon, it can say whatever you want it to say.
Actually, it did. Spoke very well.
And starting out with the cover, I love the cover art. Cover art is awesome.
Yeah, talk about that.
The cover was the driving kind of force to get it done, because I commissioned Claudio Bergamon, incredibly talented artist, to do the cover. I said, this is the concept that I'd like. Can you execute it? And, you know, if people see it, they will remember kind of the publicity photo that was used for the tour. So that is the basis. But the characters themselves were taken from screen captures rather than using the photograph as the basis. So I then said, just interpret it. And we had a little bit of back and forth on instruments, and I went with what was aesthetically pleasing rather than necessarily what was 100% period accurate, because it's art.
Cool. Right.
And if I wanted a photo that was photo, I would have had a photo. So I think he did a great job. He got the aura colors and everything represented. And behind me, there's Paul. So I'm very happy with it. And it seems to have had a very positive response from people. Claudio has been selling prints of this for quite a while with my blessing. But he's the owner of the art, and he just licensed it to me.
Yeah, it's very fantastic.
It's really cool. It's actually really cool. I mean, like I said, that catches you. It's like, you know, Bill's always said about, you know, the first song on an album. Well, the cover, you know, cover will hit me on a book, you know, you know, give me a black cover, I may not look at it.
Yeah, but it's important also to have the insides match the quality of the outside. And, you know, one of the problems with that is the back cover, as Daniel pointed out on when they reviewed the book on the FAQ podcast. You know, they're like, you have this wonderful front cover, and then you flip it around and you've got that. And it's like, by that point, I was out of steam. And it's just like,
you got anything.
here's the hype paragraph that's going to be on everything. I'm just replicating. I'm not putting any pictures or anything. I did have a picture I wanted to license. I couldn't get it in the end. So it is what it is. Again, the front cover is what matters the most. I think the back cover just has the bare minimum of details. But I was more interested in focusing on the guts.
Well, in this case, I would say that it's okay to judge a book by the cover.
Right.
I hope so. And again, you know, the response has been generally positive. You know, some of the negatives to it, well, apart from Eric Stahlhallen, sorry, Sweden, I will apologize to them. I missed an S. in two places. I spelt a Spanish word wrong because I went with what was on the memo rather than running it through the translator to check the spelling of the memo. So I blame a coin for that. And then I think like three lines got cut off on the interior. So, you know, things do happen. Is it perfect? Well, no, it's a Julian book, but it's been through multiple proofers. It's been through professional copy editing. A lot more attention and detail goes into these now, as I've learned way more during the process over the years.
So that's what I was curious about. Like, how do you, how do you determine when you think something's ready to go to a proofreader? Or are you doing it all along as you're doing the book, or do you finish the book and then send it to proofreading, or what's the process typically?
I generally do it, the book first, and then send it out to proofreading, and then we start axing away at things. And then, you know, once it's been through copy editing and proofing and copy editing again and proofing again and proofing again, I'm still cutting things out right until the end because I run out of space on some pages. I'm like, okay, I got to kill 10 words here. Let's look at, you know, again, just refining things right down to make sure everything fits within the tolerances that I need for printing. Then I do a physical proof and see how it all comes together, because I'm not using InDesign to do this. I am backwards. I cannot learn InDesign to save my life. I have tried. So I don't have the flexibility that a professional publishing product has to just be moving boxes around. Like, I'm not going to say that word, you know, in software to make everything work.
So what for you was the most difficult part of putting this project together?
I think getting contributions was a massive challenge. Once I go through what I have, and I've got an awful lot. I actually bought Eric Carr's press file from 1980 at auction years ago. So I had a very good starting point, but it didn't have a lot of European stuff. Finding people who are willing to contribute openly is a challenge these days. I don't know why. So there are a couple of countries. Well, there's one country that really feels neglected in there, France, which is a shame because I would have liked to have been able to tell more of that story than I was ultimately able to. I mean, it's very Paris-centric, unfortunately. Germany was a big problem until right at the end. And then, you know, several saviors came forward with some really fantastic contributions that really, they're the ones whose contributions made it happen, because I was I'm always on the precipice of walking away from it, calling it a weed and shrugging my shoulders and saying, it's not working out. I can't put this out. It's done. And, you know, move on to another plant. So this one was really challenging in that aspect. When you think you've got a lot of stuff and can tell a story, and then you put it all together and you look at that story, there's when you see the gaps, and there's where other people see the gaps, or that you're, you know, sending out early proofs to for feedback.
Well, we do know that KISS fans are very meticulous.
KISS fans are wonderfully brutal. And KISS fans are absolutely amazing. The moment I sold one copy, I was like, hallelujah, someone has trusted me with their money, because they have put their money down to see something that I've produced. And that means that's almost holy, because they're trusting you to give them something that is worth their hard earned money. It doesn't get any easier, though. I find now, as I'm getting older as well, to do these things. So.
But the thing is, Jillian, too, you're known as somebody who does put out books. I mean, you this is not your first rodeo. You put these things out, and every time you do one, they're well done. And like I said, you go that extra mile to make sure that they're all not perfect, but, you know, as perfect as it can be. So
I've got a box full of corpses, you know, of books that have not happened. Books right. That have gone a long way. I've got a 700-page book right now sitting behind me that I don't know if it's going to happen. Wow. And it's already at 700 pages. It really is. Not all ideas work out when it comes to this game, especially working as an unofficial, you know, publisher without the resources. Again, I have to fund every single aspect of these things, and it is not cheap when it all adds up before it ever gets out the door or ever gets to the point where, you know, the National Rock and Pod, I had the very first proof available for people to flip through. And there was no guarantee that it was going to happen. There was no guarantee in May that it was going to happen. So again, all those projects that I have abandoned, I do this because I get a kick out of it. I love digging into the history and organizing it for my own edification first. I really hope other fans enjoy it as well. And it seems that many do. But first and foremost, it's almost an addiction. I want to organize this information that I have. I don't worry about what I don't have, to see if it tells a story to me. So I'm very cheap entertainment.
And it actually shows.
You're though, in good company. I mean,
it actually shows, though. That's like I was saying earlier. It shows in the stuff that you do put out. You're not doing it just to put it out. You're doing it for yourself.
And you know what's super fun is, you know, spending hours in the library with microfilm. Oh, when you get a delivery of microfilm in from interlibrary loan, oh, I'm like happy face. I'm like, I got to the afternoon. I'm going down to the library. I'm walking down the road. I'm like, oh, like you walk down the road like that in San Francisco and someone thinks you're doing something that you really shouldn't be. But I get in there, I'm like winding the machine. I'm like, you know, I got my headphones on, I'm listening to some Stones or something, and I go to a happy place. It's escapism. I don't want to watch Netflix. I don't want to watch, you know, Survivor or any reality TV or the news. You know, I want the news from, you know, 45 years ago. It's much more fun.
That's cool. That is cool.
Yeah, it's so when you write these books, do you have what to you means success for the books? It's not sales. I mean, obviously sales are good because they pay, but what are you looking for as, because I think this is an art too, right? And I think authors do that because that's what drives them and stuff like that. So what is your reward from these?
I think when I read a comment from someone said, wow, I learned something, I didn't know that. Or if someone then comes back and says, well, you didn't think about it this way. And I'm like, well, I've learned something. You know, it's a two-way exchange. You're going to have people come to you and say, well, you forgot this, you forget this, you forgot this. And you're like, ooh, ooh, ooh. You're like, oh, you're laying candy out here. There's a trap about to fall on me. You know, so that's a reward in itself, is when someone has learned something or someone has relived something. There is nothing better than, you know, one of these on tour books when someone comes up to your table at an in-person event and they immediately flip through it. They're like going through it until they find that first show that they ever went to. And they're like, Oh yeah. I remember that. Oh, you know, those things, that's the biggest reward right there. When someone, you know, remembers something from their past, reliving it in front of you is absolutely brilliant. You know, and again, that first sale where someone has trusted you, that's really important. What is the goal? Yeah. Break even, is nice. You know, some of the books I put out are still at a loss. Hasn't stopped me. You know, I'm not doing this, you know, for world domination. I don't shift that sort of numbers. I know that, you know, I don't have a publishing logo. I don't have any of that. It's not for that. It's not for reviews. It's not for podcasts. It's really to see someone enjoy it is what makes it worthwhile.
Cool.
That is cool. Yeah. Like I said, I envy you to be able to do that. I mean, to be able to put this together. I mean, that's a lot of information. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears that you put into these books.
But it makes me revisit the albums as well and reconsider them. You know, I wasn't a fan of Crazy Nights. So I do a book on Crazy Nights. I'm not a big fan on the Unmasked album. So I do that. This one, excuse me, this one is not just from the individual tour books. It's because of Odyssey. And we've learned an awful lot since that book came out about 1981. So I start writing that up and rewriting, you know, the 1981 history of after Unmasked. I'm like, I can't do something with that and put out Odyssey again. Already done that. That's the past. What do I do to present all this new information about Kiss going into the Elder? Well, go backwards and talk about, you know, 1980. I mean, look at that year. Peter Criss leaves the band. Casablanca blows up. Kiss gets a new record deal. They get Eric Carr. They go on, you know, their second visit to Europe. They go to Australia for the first time. There's an awful lot of things in that year. Well, yeah, and America forgets about them. To be able to talk about. And you don't just get to cater to an American band. This is where the band was really owned by the world more so than at home. So it's nice to be able to do a book that focuses on Europe and Australia and New Zealand, of course. So it's nice because the Kiss Army is worldwide.
Yeah, what I found interesting about it too was, you know, looking through the you know, the stuff that we had, the contract information in there and that kind of stuff. And, you know, it with all that stuff that you were talking about that was going on, you know, Peter leaving the band and the different contracts and stuff like that. And the fact that, you know, like you said, the U.S. was pretty much they were going a different different direction. I mean, fans were leaving by the flock full. You know, this could have been the end. I mean, very well, you know, when I was reading this and I was thinking about it, you know, I was thinking about that time and thinking about how do you get that back? And it really, that could have been the end of the band. I mean, it could have been that they all four just, you know, went their own separate ways because, you know, of all things that happened, especially after the tour was over when they came back. And it's like, okay, the tour is over. We don't really have anything ready. We're not really ready to go into the studio again for the new record. You know, there's all these things that just pointed to, it's just a miracle that it even continued, at least. And that's not, I mean, that's not, it's not written that way. It's just when you look at all the stories along there and all the things that happened, to me, it just really made me very surprised that they didn't end up going, you know what, we're just, because they lost their asses.
That is the great thing about this is that 1980 contract sets them up for the rest of the decade. The rest of the decade is a response and a reaction to everything that seemed to go right, $2 million an album, but actually went very, very wrong for the band because it's just a cavalcade of dominoes falling after the signing of that contract. It has nothing to do with Peter leaving. That's written into the contract. It's the delivery time for the next album. Clock is ticking from May 1980, and they're missing deadlines in 81. And then they're not feeling creative juices. They go through two recording sessions, what was it, Ace in the Hole in January, February, and then Toronto in May, which have nothing to do with the Elder. No Elders in sight. Morpheus does not exist. And then they're late delivering an album, and then it bombs, and then they're under the pressure again for Creatures and Killers, and it's just a domino effect of everything going bad, Ace leaving. It really sets up the soap opera, which again is what makes it worthwhile to investigate, because once you start digging into that contract and presenting the parts that matter rather than the whole darn thing, because who wants to read a contract apart from me? You know, you get to cherry pick some of the most interesting parts. I didn't cherry pick all of them either. There's a couple of things I left out that I now regret leaving out.
But, you know, even being that, you know, for us who were living, you know, lived through that and we're fans through that era, you know, this book is telling you things that, you know, we got a candy coating of what was happening to Kiss at that point. You know, you were getting like little blurps, you know, because back that was, you know, pre-internet everything. So we were getting out of the circus magazines, Hit Parader, you know, this is what was happening. This is what's going on. You know, we were force fed what the publicist wanted us to know about Kiss, not knowing that all this bullshit was going on with the band. You know, that's what's so crazy about it. That's what's good about this book. You know, we're able, now we're getting to hear the you know, the rest of the story, if you want to say it that way.
Yeah, and now we actually get to put it all. I mean, we're spoiled with the internet and technology. I mean, this is just gathering a whole bunch of things that are, I guess, kind of known, and putting them in one place and trying to organize them. There are going to be some things in there that are new to people. The 1980 contracts, I'm not aware of, you know, circulating out there. I'm sure some collectors have them, but generally they have not been out. So, you know, a lot of that's new information. A lot of the memos, which really tell the story of a band and a business, are in there. You know, and that's kind of, it's evidence. I'm not presenting any case. I'm not trying to prove them guilty or prove their innocence in anything. I don't think I have a bias. Hopefully no bias comes through, and no one can tell I'm not a big fan of Unmasked musically. Because I don't have an agenda. I didn't set out with, because I started in 1981 and moved backwards, maybe that's the safest way to do some of these projects, that you've got your conclusion already done. Now you have to go backwards and, you know, and just tell the story so you can be unbiased. You can not try and skew anything. You're not trying to make Peter look good or bad, or Kiss look good or Kiss look bad, because the contract's in black and white. That spells it all out. So there's no one's face to save.
You're just giving facts. I mean, you're just, like you said, you're giving the facts, putting them in order, and then do with
hopefully,
what you
hopefully
want.
Not putting anyone to sleep, right?
But you know what? People like us, you know, we want to delve into that, because, you know, this, you know, like I said, the contracts, we weren't, you know, I never seen one, you know, so I want to read through it, you know, and see this. So, yeah, it's just
interesting having this type of access to those kinds of things that you don't normally get. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know of any other band, and I would know, because I wouldn't dive in. I don't dive into any other band like I do Kiss and that kind of stuff. But I don't know of any other band that has. How many books have you done, Julian?
I don't know.
That's an right there.
That's, okay, that's a very good point. I mean, right, yeah, there. I mean, there's.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of anybody else that. I mean, you could go to some Def Leppard site, and I can't imagine they have 10 Def books Leppards. Out about Def Leppard. I know they have. So there's just not that, and I just don't know of a band that has that kind of.
Mm-hmm. There's one.
I don't know, history or knowledge or interest that people would want, you know, want to hear more about it. And it's, you know, the interesting thing about it too is even in this, you still kind of keep the mystique of the whole Kiss thing going on. Throughout.
Yeah. That just kind of happens again. Yeah. There's no conscious, I need to do this to this person. No, there's none of that, but you know, we're so lucky with Kiss. I don't know of another band, and certainly I love Motley, I love Def Leppard, Aerosmith. I don't know other bands that have thousands of band memos available for collectors to get our grubby mitts on. I don't know other bands that you can get their contracts to. And when you've got their 73 contract, their 75, their 77, you know, their 80, and 82 recording contracts. I just don't know of other bands that allow you, from that material that is available out there, to be able to paint this picture internally of what's going on. Because again, the band memos, they're just so critically important to telling a story. If they can be organized into a way. And I didn't see that with the Aerosmith project. I mean, that's why I did the Aerosmith project, because I didn't have any of that stuff. And I had to go back and really recreate it all myself. With Kiss, I can turn around and say, well, I've got a binder 7 inches thick there for Destroyer. There's Creatures, you know, 3 inches thick. You know, I can do books on dedicated to those tomorrow if I so choose. Dynasty. Well, there's multiple binders for that, you know, so we're spoiled when it comes to Kiss fans.
I'm coming to San Francisco. I'm looking through all of it.
So Julian, you're saying that these other bands, you know, you don't know if any other band has access to these memos and stuff. So how do we get access to these memos? How are they put out to the public? Was that through a coin?
I think a lot came through the warehouse. And that's the guess of some of the binders that I've obtained. I mean, just I got like 3 binders at the end of the Odyssey project. Number one, it had a ton of Elder stuff in it, you know, right down to the studio bills. But it also had, it was just terse copyright filings and lawsuits that the lawyers were filing, you know, to get rid of competing trademarks, you know, really stuff that you can't do anything with. I think a lot of it comes from there. I think Allcoin management had a lot of people who kept a lot of stuff and eventually got rid of it in bulk. Because KISS has always had a very strong collector fan base, sure, who would do some pretty wild stuff, you know, back in the old days to get a lot of this stuff. So when Johnny comes lately, Mr. 1985 Asylum fan comes along and decides to get into the history side of the band, a lot of that stuff has been gathered and is trading just like bootlegs were. You know, people circulating, people selling, you know, winning auctions, a lot of paperwork. You know, I bought, who was it? Can't remember. Eddie Blandis's paperwork, one auction. So, you know, some of it. You know, I bought Eric Carr's press file for 1980. I had his from 1981 as well. You know, I got a lot of paperwork from other people directly connected with the band. So, again, could I sit on this and just hoard it? Yeah. But could I scan it and put it out there? Yeah, I've shared a lot of it. But the librarian in me likes to organize. Right. So the book is just a glorified Dewey Decimal System of KISS memos.
and we appreciate it.
No, it's just really interesting, like you said, you know, KISS has always been over the top on everything as far as collectibles and just the way the people that follow them, the people that, you know, when you're a KISS fan, you are a KISS fan. You are, you know, and it, like you said, it's weird that, you know, name any other band around and like memos and bills and stuff like that. They all got thrown away. No, you know, nobody give a shit about it. Even if you found them, it's like, I don't want to see this bullshit.
KISS fans will dig up landfill.
They will. That's what I'm saying. KISS fans is like, going, this is a used tissue from 1973.
If somebody said there's a bag of trash buried 30 feet deep in the earth that's got X, Y, and Z in it, somebody's going to go, you know what? I'll get my ass a backhoe. And we're going after it. I mean,
well. Yep. Speaking of KISS trash, I have been meaning to tell you guys this for a long time, but you guys went to the Robert Stadium Creatures or Crazy Night show, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know the towel that Gene wiped his face with?
Right.
I've got it.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
A friend of mine gave it to me.
Well, how cool.
It's in a bag and I'm scared to open it because I don't know what it'll smell like after 35 years.
I just leave that in the bag,
man. Yeah.
Will crabs stay alive that long in a bag? Like
I don't know. So back to the seriousness. I have 2 more things.
Wait, we're being serious?
No.
Not okay. Here. Never. Not on this show.
Let me rephrase that. Back to the subject we're supposed to be talking about. How's that?
Okay.
Do you have any plans to put this out as a hardback or is it paperback only? And why?
I'm currently waiting for a hardback. I had a problem with the hardbacks originally. I wasn't happy with the paper stock. It's heavier paper, but it was lighter in color. And as you can tell from the paperback, there's a nice contrast level, which makes the readability pop out a bit more. So the cover artist actually persuaded me to do the hardback. I mean, he really loved, I did some proof copies. I sent him one. I got rid of the other one. And his reaction to it made me rethink it. So, yeah, I've got an order of I'm going to do very few. They're just not. Prices are up, which means prices are up. And it's affected the pricing of the paperback already. And we're getting into a pricing point that I'm not comfortable operating in as a small independent nobody. But, yes, there will be a limited amount of hardcovers. I'm also – I don't have one – Well, I got rid of my last one. So I also wasn't happy with how the hardcover, the cover image leaves a bit of blue gap for the spine, just a necessity of the design and the construction. But other than that, I mean, I'll see when they get in. If they meet expectations, I've already am shipping some in Australia and Europe because I order them directly and ship them straight to the customers. Those will be available, but there'll be information with that will be on maskhysteria.com when the time comes.
Right on. And the only other thing that I have is there anything you want to say about this particular book that no one has asked you?
No, there isn't. It's all just gratitude. Again, I'm really thrilled by the response to it. Some of the constructive criticism, the feedback has been, very positive in that it's beneficial feedback. But I'm just eternally grateful to the support of the KISS community. Not only folks like you having me on your show and also having, obtained copies for yourself of the work, but for everyone who supported me over the years. I mean, this is like, 22 years of doing this now? And the KISS Army has just been really supportive of me over all those years, and it keeps me motivated to keep doing this stuff, even though every time I do one, I say it's the last time I'm ever bloody well doing this.
please keep doing it, Jillian, because we do enjoy them. We really do.
Thanks, Dennis.
Because we're not going to be doing it. I'm not going to be sitting at the library looking at microfish. I mean,
no, I keep coming up with all these what I think are awesome ideas, book ideas. I'm like, someone's got to do this. I'm just someone. So, oh, bloody hell, I'll do it myself.
You know what, somebody's got to do it. It's a dirty job, but
that's right. Jillian will jump in there and do it.
My name is Julian, and I'm addicted to KISS drink.
There you go. There's a lot of work. There's a lot worse addictions.
Thank goodness maybe. For that. No kidding.
Well, before we get out of here, Julian, promote your socials and your the link to where people can buy this book and all of that hysterical nonsense.
Yep. Maskhysteria.com. It'll take you everywhere you need to go in order to find the book on paperback, regardless of where you are. And the hardcover will be publicized probably on the KISS FAQ message board, which will be also up on maskhysteria.com. So my socials, maskhysteria.com for this project.
All right. Well, y'all visit agentsofrock.com, check out past episodes, social media links, and until next time, peace out. Thanks for listening to the Ages of Rock podcast. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, and most importantly, tell all your friends. Remember, you're never too old to rock. Until the next episode, peace out, folks.